Welcome to the Outdoor Dream Jobs podcast, where we round up the hottest jobs available in the outdoor industry each week, and then we go in depth with coveted outdoor brands to find out what it's like to work at each of them. I'm Allie Carr.
And I'm Jenna Selmer. We run Basecamp, an online community of more than 21,000 outdoor industry insiders who share jobs, industry contacts, and advice.
This week, we are surveying our community to find out what their number one challenge is with finding their dream job in the outdoor industry. So if you would like to fill us in on where you are finding challenges, go to our show notes where you'll find a link to the survey. We would love to hear your voice and have you partake. We find every single response super valuable, and it would just make all our dreams come true if you would join in. So please help us shape the future of Basecamp. We would love it.
Yeah, help us help you. And that link is just outdoordreamjobs.com, same as the show title, kept it easy for you. And today we have such an exciting interview. We looked at all of our data from our newsletter and from all of the jobs that we published last year. And the top click job was from Protect Our Winters. Every time we put this organization in our newsletter or in our podcast, the clicks went nuts. So we know that you folks want to hear more about them, and we're going to be interviewing their executive director, Mario Molina, and he's working hand in hand with Pro Snowboarder and Protect Our Winters founder Jeremy Jones. He hails from Guatemala, but now he's living in Colorado. So it's a very interesting journey that he's had. The organization is phenomenal, and you're really going to want to figure out how you can get your leg up on your application with this one. So definitely stay tuned.
Yes, absolutely. And they were number one out of thousands of jobs. So really, really cool. I can't wait to hear what he has to say. But first, let's talk jobs, as always. The first job is with Cliff, which is, as you know, Cliff Bars. They're based in Emeryville, California, which is in the Bay Area. And they are looking for a senior director of research and science in their R&D department. So somebody who has a very, very strong understanding of nutrition, athlete nutrition, the way, you know, that foods work in all of our bodies, as well as work in conjunction with our energetic outputs. And this person will really be, you know, improving the market position for Cliff and probably doing studies to try to figure out some claims that they can make. So if you're into science and you're into nutrition and you are a fan of Cliff, who has always made Outside's Best Places to Work list, then I would definitely recommend applying for this position.
That'd be so much fun. High Country News, which is located in Western United States, has a couple of really interesting fellowships available. This is a magazine and website, and they cover the West. So everything from Alaska to the Rocky Mountains, the deserts, really anything in the West related to ecological issues, social and political, catering to outdoor enthusiasts and environmental professionals and public land managers. That's what they're covering here. So they have a very cool fellowship open called the Virginia Spencer Davis Fellowship, and it's going to be a flexible working situation. Obviously, it's entry level, 30 to 35 hours a week, and it is paid at the rate of $1,187 bi-weekly, and that includes a work from home allowance because this is a remote position, and they also give you support with some IT equipment. So that is wonderful. They also have a climate justice fellowship. You're going to be working with so many editors, and you're also going to be working with Indigenous communities, which I found really, really neat. So anybody that is going to want to up their writing chops for a very hearty 6-month fellowship should definitely look into High Country News. And again, it's remote, but you do have to be in the Western United States, but that's where I'd want to be anyway.
The next position is with the Appalachian Mountain Club, and they are based in Boston, Massachusetts. However, this role would be primarily remote and working from home to start. This is a development coordinator position, and they're looking for somebody who has a BA and also has about 2 to 3 years of administrative experience. So it's semi-entry level as long as you've had some administrative experience. And they're really looking for somebody who's going to support their fundraising team from kind of a service and systems kind of approach. So they're looking for somebody who can really think about how can they best support the people out there raising the money for Appalachian Mountain Club. So if you are super organized and you, you know, like to think about the best way to tackle things from a logic perspective, then I think that this would be a great position for you, especially just to get your foot in the door if you're interested in conservation, nonprofits. The salary range is $40,000 to $45,000. So also that kind of indicates that it is more of an entry-level position.
Mm-hmm. Zero Shoes is also hiring an e-commerce copywriter with about 3 years of experience in Broomfield, Colorado. Zero Shoes are those ones that the toes are all separate, so you might have seen them and know what I'm talking about now. But this person is going to be creating their pitch-perfect copy. They're going to be doing it for websites, third-party marketplaces, partner sites, kind of like whatever they need, you're going to be writing for them. They want somebody, also for brand videos, which is a kind of a whole new world for some copywriters. So they would love somebody that does have familiarity with trends in the outdoors and really good knowledge of SEO. And online marketing, and someone that has really good project management skills would also be great for this company. One thing I did note in the job description is that you get a free pair of shoes each month of employment. So that's kind of a cool perk. And then the salary itself is between $45,000 and $60,000.
Nice. Free shoes. I love that. The next job is also in footwear, but it's a little bit different. It's with Catula. And if you're not familiar with them, they make micro spikes that many, many people wear when they go hiking in the winter. I personally, you know, definitely love this brand and micro spikes from my experience hiking in Santa Fe, living there in the winter, and ice skating down a few trails, sometimes on my butt. Yeah. I definitely recommend micro spikes, and this brand is just super cool. They're based in Flagstaff, Arizona. So also a really, really lovely place to live where we don't see too many opportunities, but it's so beautiful there with mountains. They have a ski resort. It's pretty high up, lots of pine trees. It's really, really high desert, but beautiful kind of mountain terrain. And they're looking for a marketing and communications associate. This is somebody who has 2 to 5 years of experience and can really help Catula get their name out there. You know, they definitely want somebody who is going to be passionate about helping to grow Catula and somebody who, you know, is creative but also logistical, and will be basically working on their workbook, advertisements, catalogs, sales materials, email newsletters, social media. You'll have your hand in pretty much everything that the brand communicates with. So if you're interested in being up in the mountains in Arizona and working on an awesome trail product, then this could be a great position for you.
And finally, All Gear is hiring a community manager. This is more of an entry-level role, but it's for somebody that really wants to prove themselves. If you don't know All Gear, Gear Junkie actually merged into this conglomerate with a lot of other publications like AutoWise, iRunFar.com, BikeRumor.com, and GearHungry.com. So the person managing community would have a focus on those, but may also work for instance, Gear Junkie. This is a fully remote position at the rate of $35,000 to $40,000. And the person in this role, I think, is going to have a very fun job with a lot of emphasis on newsletters and social media. So they want somebody that can get right in there, understand how the community on social media is communicating, and do so on their level in a way that makes them want to come back to these channels again and again. Same with the email platforms. So you're going to want to be somebody that knows most of the social media channels already. If you don't maybe brush up on those, they're going to want you to know all of them. You know, at least be familiar with MailChimp. You're going to need to know Photoshop for this as well, and you're going to need to be a team player. So super fun job for somebody for whom that all sounds great.
Awesome. All right, I'm really excited to talk about Protect Our Winters. Let's go.
My name is Mario Molina. I'm the executive director for POW, Protect Our Winters. And I am based out of Rawlinsville, Colorado, which is a huge metropolis of about 200 people just west of Boulder.
Huge. Now, for anyone who hasn't heard of Protect Our Winters, can you tell us a little bit about it, please?
Yeah, POW was started in about 10 years ago by big mountain snowboarder Jeremy Jones, who really pioneered human-powered snowboarding, splitboarding into the Great Ranges of Alaska and into the Himalayas. And in one of those many expeditions, he really became aware of how big the impact of climate change were on snowpack across the big mountain ranges and how much the sport that he loved would be affected. So he came back and wanted to work with a nonprofit that was mobilizing the outdoor sports community into climate action, and realized that such a nonprofit didn't exist. So in true Jeremy fashion, he founded Protect Our Winters, POW, which at the time was a relatively small organization, but small but mighty has been, like to characterize ourselves. But since then, I joined in 2017, and since I joined, we've grown. We're now a staff of about 13 people going through a round of hiring right now. And our mission really is to turn passionate outdoors people into effective climate advocates. We work with business leaders, elite athletes, and the outdoor sports community as a whole to move climate policies, bipartisan climate policies and climate solutions forward in order to protect the landscapes where we love to recreate and play and refresh.
You joined in 2017 as the executive director, correct? You joined at that level?
Mm-hmm, that's correct, yeah.
What was your career trajectory like, and how did you break into the industry?
It was a bit of a pinball trajectory, I would say, more so than a straight path.
That's good to hear. I think that makes a lot of people feel better.
I ran an outdoor guide. I'm originally from Guatemala, and I ran an outdoor shop, like a guide and outdoor gear shop in Guatemala after college for about 3 years, and realized that at some point I was going to need to grow up. So decided to go back to school and went for a master's degree in a combination of ecology and hydrology at Appalachian State University in North Carolina. That's where I first heard about, you know, the academic research behind climate change. But at the time, I really thought that it was a problem that we'd have to deal with 50 years into the future. I was far more concerned with water scarcity and permitting of wetlands. So got pretty technical there for a while and realized the only way that I was going to make a decent living at the time in that space was to do consulting for the exact same type of people and corporations that I was trying to keep from doing the work they were doing, right? So there was a lot of work in doing environmental assessments for corporations that were trying to get a stamp on a permit to develop over wetlands or develop land. And that was just not what I was interested in doing. So I had the opportunity to go to work for an organization that did a combination of adventure travel and education and outdoor and sorry and ecology conservation education. So I did that for about 10 years, and that took me to Australia. I spent about 6 to 8 months in Australia, then did some work in the Dominican Republic, and then ended up in Ecuador and worked in Ecuador for about 5 years. Building and designing the program. So I would pick the projects that we would bring volunteers, mostly college students from Europe and the US, to do 2 weeks of volunteer work. And then I would design an adventure travel itinerary throughout Ecuador that went for about 2 weeks. And so the program as a whole was a month, and we would move about, any given year, I'd move probably about 700 college students through the program between May and September. So wow. It was a crazy busy few months, and then had some time to climbing and stuff that we like to do out in the mountains in South America. But what started happening was two things. One is I started noticing how rapidly glacial recession was affecting a lot of the Andes glaciers, and what the severe impact would be of absolute glacial recession in the Andes in terms of freshwater availability for communities that depend on them downstream. It was in everywhere that I had been in the world, whether it was the Great Barrier Reef in Australia going through coral bleaching, whether it was increased storm frequency and intensity in the Dominican Republic, or whether it was glacial recession in Ecuador. I realized that the common denominator across all of these phenomena was in the intensity and the rapid rate of change that we were going through in the climate. So I got far more interested in climate change at the time. There was also at the time a hope that the U.S. would pass a cap and trade bill. So that I'm dating myself. This was 2010, the Waxman-Markey bill, which was known as a cap and trade bill, and it completely collapsed. And that got me really interested in policy and what, why was it that, you know, this very obvious problem that had so much momentum at the time in Congress had completely failed to yield any kind of legislative action. I ended up moving back to the U.S. as the deputy director for an organization focused on mobilizing high school students called the Alliance for Climate Education. It was a bit of a startup at the time, and when I joined, and our mandate was to reach 2 million students, get to reaching almost 1 million students per year, and reach 2 million students over the next 3 years. From there, I was recruited to join former Vice President Al Gore's organization, the Climate Reality Project, and I was in charge of running in the trainings that the Vice President does for people that he wants to teach how to deliver his presentation on which An Inconvenient Truth is based, as well as briefing him on international missions on who the audience was, what we were trying to achieve in the country, etc. And then in 2015, after the Paris Agreement was signed, my portfolio transitioned to being the international director for that organization, which was great, fantastic job. I got to meet some incredible leaders, the vice president himself, but also the energy minister of India, the head of the Brazilian Climate Change Forum in Congress, leaders from the World Bank, and some really amazing thought leaders in this space. But it was also just not a culture that I felt like I belonged to. It involved a lot of travel, and it involved a lot of suits and ties, and it involved a lot of formalities. And so as interesting as it was for the 5 years that I was there, and as much as I was learning, I just really didn't feel like it was a good cultural fit. And we had the 2016 election, so the U.S. pulling out of Paris. There was this combination of, okay, it's not just not a great cultural fit, but now I'm doing mostly international work, and what we really need to do is get the U.S. back on track. If we live in the U.S. or if you have any possibility for influence within the U.S., that needs to be the number one priority. So at the time, I was friends with the former executive director of POW, and he let me know that he was stepping down. I had met Jeremy a couple of times. I had met some of the board members a couple of times. So it was just the right position, the right fit at the right time. My background as an alpinist and person who loves the outdoors and mountain bike, I like to say I'm a mediocre snowboarder, somewhat decent climber, and a little better mountain biker. If I have to do anything, I'd rather go snowboarding with Conrad Anker and climbing with Jeremy, because then I can kind of hold my own.
I was going to say everybody's a mediocre snowboarder compared to Jeremy.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so it was just the perfect position at the right fit. I remember actually having a conversation about this a few months before the position became open, and somebody said, well, what's your dream job? Executive director at POW. But at the time, my friend Chris had it. And a couple of months later, Chris told me, hey, I'm stepping down. I thought, well, ask and ye shall receive, said somebody once.
And tell us a little bit more just about how your love for the outdoors started. So did you grow up in an outdoorsy location? Tell us a little bit about that.
I grew up in Guatemala. And my first real date with the outdoor adventure, I was about 12 years old, and my mother had stuck me in one of those after-school programs that was run by a really well-meaning but not very competent young group of people in their 20s who decided that what they would do was take 30 or 40 of us, you know, preteens, to climb this 13,800-foot volcano in Guatemala. And we all piled into this bus, drove the 3 hours to the trailhead, and started hiking up without a plan or a briefing. There were people carrying cans, and I had a homemade sleeping bag. Make a long story a little shorter, we didn't make the summit or the expected campsite. We were spread out over probably a quarter of a mile on the slopes of this volcano. Couldn't pitch tents. Spent a freezing night trying to figure out where everybody was. And I woke up and I absolutely loved it. And then that morning, the sun rose, and it cast the shadow of this volcano across a cloud on the other side with all the pastel colors of dawn. And then the volcano that's right next to it, called Santiaguito, erupted. And so we got to see this eruption bird's eye view of an eruption at dawn over this majestic, almost mystical cloud. And wow. From that point on, I was just absolutely hooked. I knew that there was nothing that I would rather do than chase moments like that for the rest of my life.
Wow, unbelievable. That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, that'll do it. Mario, can you tell us, you've worked at a couple places then in the outdoor industry. What's it like working at POW? Like, what's the culture like and the folks that you're working with?
We are currently 13 people and we are hiring. We right now have 3 open positions that we're hiring for and getting ready to post another 2 or 3 over the course of the next couple of months.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So you are expanding greatly.
We are. It's exciting. It's great. For a long time, I think the way that people describe POW is that we punched above our weight, which is a great thing. But if you weigh 120 pounds, that's still not a whole lot of punch. So now we're really trying to put on some weight and deliver. The work that we've done over the last couple of years has really shown that we have the right group of people, the right strategy, vision, and the support of so many incredible people in the community that I feel like it's our responsibility to actually deliver on the promise and grow on that promise. And so a lot of it has to do with making sure that we have enough people to support our alliance, our alliance members, that we are doing the right reporting by our donors and engaging our donors in the right ways, that we're freeing up more staff time for programs, and that we're bringing on. One of the positions that we're hiring for is actually a campaigns director to help us be more fully dedicated to impactful campaigns, as well as a vice president of communications and marketing to up-level our communications and our marketing. In terms of the culture, it's when I was training for raft guiding, somebody once told me, like, the most challenging boat you can have is a raft filled with guides, because they're all type A personalities, right? And so everyone wants to paddle as hard as they can when they want to paddle as hard as they can. And I think that what it really takes is it takes a really concerted effort of having paddled together for a while to put all of those skills and passion in and steer the boat in the right way. And I feel like at POW, that's kind of where we're at. We have a lot of really high performers, high achievers who are really passionate about the outdoors, who we are now, I think, really we're finding our paddle stroke in terms of working together in a coordinated fashion, which it was a pretty drastic change to go from being in person to being remote through COVID. Mm-hmm. And the team just pivoted so well. And it's been really impressive to see everyone working so collaboratively and so effectively together. I would say it's definitely a high performance, highly driven culture with lots of creative ideas, but also very collaborative. People seem to have each other's backs when something is needed, whether it's within their scope of work or not. I try to instill a work-life balance, and so I think I should have revised it this winter. We usually have a 6-inch rule. If there's 6 inches of powder, you don't have to show up for work until you've gotten a few runs in. But considering how crappy the winter we had, at least in the front range this year, I should have dropped that to like a 2-inch rule. And then when in person, we try and get out. So we'll get out. Yeah, when we don't have COVID restrictions, we try and get out together. There was a group of staff that had like a mountain bike group on Wednesday afternoons last year. We usually do 1 or 2 ski days together. So obviously, we try and congregate around the things that we're passionate about.
Is your team expected to go back to the office full time, or are you going to be doing some sort of hybrid thing in the future? Have you discussed that?
That is a great question. We've discussed it. We haven't landed it. And so we've had several team members actually relocate during the crisis. I don't expect that we'll be asking them to come back to be in person after COVID. And so the positions that we're hiring for, some of them are listed as having a preference for Boulder, but open to remote. But it's very likely that we'll open them up to just be remote. Most of the candidates that we're getting are actually not based in Boulder, and we've just seen that it works well. In terms of the staff that are still in the area, I think that we're going to have to come up with a bit of a hybrid so that we have to me, what's important is we're going to need to have representation from the various teams to be able to interact in person on a semi-regular basis. whatever that means. But being able to have people in the office doing brainstorming sessions, planning meetings, etc., who represent the different department, I think is my preference. I am really, really fortunate. I have an excellent VP of programs and operations. And so what the final answer looks like, I am very glad to say, will not be up to me.
I mean, I think that you're going through what so many other organizations are, in that the workforce wants to be remote. I mean, we've adjusted and we know how to work from home. And also your talent pool, being able to leverage the entire, you know, nation and maybe beyond, is such a benefit to all organizations that care about a culture ad. And not everyone's as lucky as some folks are to live in Boulder. So
yeah, and it's been interesting because I think we were having the work from home conversation before COVID hit, and how many days, and a lot of staff really wanted to be able to work from home. So we had a 1 day work from home policy. A lot of staff were lobbying for a 2 day work from home policy. But people are just tired of Zoom.
That's like very true. Yeah.
Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting after Zoom meeting. It's, you know, they miss the in-person interaction. They miss the ability to leave the office, so to speak, rather than just leave the room or step up, go upstairs or downstairs, depending on what the case might be.
Yeah.
And the chatter, like the daily chatter, being able to pop your head out of the desk and talk to somebody. So while I think that I completely agree that it opens up for the organization, it just opens up the talent pool, and it just creates so much more flexibility. I think that there's also something that people are realizing is really valuable about that in-person collaborative work that happens, and being able to figure out how do we maintain that at least for a significant percentage of the time, if not all the time, is going to be critical.
Yeah, those little in-between human moments that we all miss so much.
It's like when you have a Zoom meeting, how do you look into someone's eyes, right? Like,
yeah.
You're looking at the screen, like, if you want to see them, or you're looking at the camera, but you never know who's looking at who.
That's true. Yeah. I feel like I'm always like looking away from everything because I'm thinking, and like when I think I tend to look up, and so like I'm always never looking at the person on the screen, which right. feels funny. But yeah, I think you're right. I mean, there is some interaction between us as humans physically when we're all in the same space and we have our nervous systems interacting. You know, we're not just brains walking on sticks, like our bodies also communicate to each other. So,
absolutely.
Yeah. So that's missing right now, which is, creating a lack of that type of interaction that we all need. So interesting. Okay. So we have two positions open, and where are you right now in that hiring process for those two positions that you mentioned?
So we are starting the third round of first interviews for the Vice President of Communications and Marketing. The position technically is still open, but I'm expecting that we'll probably be closing it here in the next week or so, week or two, as we have gotten some incredibly strong applicants. We've had about 180 applications for that position, so it's just taken us a while to actually sort through all of them and filter through. And then we're also hiring for a director of campaigns, campaigns director. And that, I think we are starting second round of first interviews this week. So timeline-wise, I think we probably have another 2 to 3 weeks for the ideally to make an offer on the first one, and then probably another week or two before we start getting to final candidates on the second, on the campaigns director.
So there's still time for somebody that thinks that this role is just absolutely ideal for them. Their application is going to need to be impeccable, but of course, Base Camp teaches them how to do that. So yeah. I have no concerns.
Can you tell a good story and then count the numbers?
Yeah.
And we will be opening another position here in 2 or 3 weeks. And that'll be for Vice President of Development as well.
Oh, wow. So that's going to be a major position for a nonprofit. Wow. Okay. And you only work in the U.S., is that correct? Because I know that there is a Protect Our Winters Canada and U.K. and Norway, I think.
We have Protect Our Winters U.K., we have Protect Our Winters Canada, we have Protect Our Winters Switzerland, and then within the what we call PAU-EU, which is the European Union. We have chapters in France, Austria, Sweden,
and Finland. I might have seen also.
Yes, and and Finland. So the Scandinavian countries, PAU-EU, PAU-UK, PAU-Canada, and then there is there's a chapter in, that I found out about last year actually, which is PAU-Japan.
Neat.
There's a PAU, and then there's a pretty active PAU New Zealand group. So our efforts over the last, really our efforts through 2019, were really focused in the U.S. 2019, we started really coordinating with the PAU-EU folks. So we did hire an a position there. We have an international manager for the PAU or a regional manager for PAU-EU. And PAU-EU is getting ready. Actually, we just secured the funding to open up for another two junior positions there, which I don't think have posted yet.
Okay, but something amazing to look out for. That's pretty cool. And so I'm assuming that there's a lot of collaboration amongst all of these chapters, but the employees that you're hiring for are focused on the U.S. Is that a good summation?
Yeah, I would say 80%, 85%. We will very likely start doing more international work towards the end of this year and doing a lot more collaboration with our chapters.
That's good to know, though, that on the horizon there might be some work where you are interacting with new geographies and regions and even topographies, things like that. So perhaps somebody with some international perspective could put that on a cover letter and stand out in that way.
For sure. Or if you have listeners who are in the EU or planning to move to the EU, keep an eye out for postings coming up there.
Yeah, I'm going to do the same, actually, just for our audience, in case anybody needs a change of pace, they can maybe head over. Mario, if you are, you know, reviewing an application or thinking about the type of person that you want to work with in these positions, what comes to mind? Or what type of culture ad would you seek?
That's a great question, because I've been doing a lot of that. I've been doing a lot of that recently. And so usually, what's unique about PAU is we cross so many different ecosystems. So, right, so we work on climate, and there's a whole culture and ecosystem around climate nonprofits. We represent the outdoor sports community and partner with the outdoor industry. And so there's a whole culture and ecosystem around the outdoor industry. We also do a lot of general environmental work in sports with our athletes. So there's a lot of athlete representation. And then there's whatever skill set we're looking for specifically, whether it be development or marketing communications or programs or campaigns, and those usually have their own culture and specifics. And so what we're usually aware that any position that we're hiring for, we're somewhat looking for a unicorn in a lot of ways, because our ideal candidate has a bit of all of the above. But what we're really looking for is, okay, can you demonstrate high competency and skills in the core set of abilities that we're looking for, with an understanding of either our industry and our community or the climate issue as a whole, and then a willingness or a demonstrated ability to learn that which you may be missing. And so if you come from a strong outdoor industry marketing world, or do you have any experience in advocacy, or are you able to demonstrate that you would be able to learn about advocacy relatively quickly, and vice versa? If you have a strong background in advocacy and maybe climate, but don't know much about the outdoor industry or outdoor sports community, then can you demonstrate that you would be able to learn that and prioritize that learning quickly? So I think strong competency and core skills coupled with demonstrated your ability to learn, or willingness to learn, and being buttressed no matter what level you're being hired for, kind of like that humility of saying, this is what I don't know, but this is how I would go about becoming familiar with it or learning it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love that. There's like humility in stating what you don't know, and then also like you can measure someone's abilities by how they can show that they can learn. So,
oh, so important, right? Like, so often I think people are really intimidated by, you know, by saying I don't know, that they'll try and BS their way through it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, as a BSer, you can spot it in a minute, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
It's like, I'm really, really impressed when somebody says, this is where I'm really strong. this is where I'm not, and this is how I would go about either buttressing that skill set or mentoring in that skill set, etc. But that in terms of cultural add-on, to me, one of the really important things at PAO is just that, you know, honesty and intellectual honesty in terms of our external communications, as well as our how we project ourselves internally to the rest of this idea of ownership. Own everything, the good, the bad, and the ugly.
An incredibly useful and unique tip for this podcast. I don't think anyone else had said, you know, specifically make a plan. And you mentioned some very good ways to do that. Either which certificates are you getting? Who are you getting to mentor you? You know, what trainings are you doing right now? Be upfront about that. And it also sounds like your team being so collaborative would be so open to somebody saying, I need to shore up in this area, who can help me or who can assist me in this project or whatever that might look like.
Absolutely. And so we're all geeks in the area that we're the strongest in, at least, you know, at PAO. And so if you ask somebody to tell you about what they know, they will.
That's okay. So that's awesome. That kind of goes into my next question of, what are some feedback mechanisms for employees? So if somebody has an idea or they have a concern, what is that process like?
Practicing what I preach, I'll be completely honest with you. We're figuring that out. We haven't had a really well-established feedback mechanism, partly because when I came on board in 2017, I was employee number 5, right? And so feedback was really simple. We'd sit around the room and we'd have a conversation and things would just come up naturally. As we've grown, and particularly in 2019, 2020, when we really experienced a lot of rapid growth, we grew faster than our systems. We have an outside HR consultant in place who checks in with the staff regularly, and then she has to check in with both my VP of programs and operations and with me once a month and once every 2 weeks, respectively. So that's a way to get anonymous feedback from the team back in terms of HR and cultural issues or questions. Then I do a monthly, for more informal or less touchy subjects, I do an informal lunch with all the, I don't want to call them junior staff, but you know, the non-executive, non-management team. Mm-hmm. And basically, before COVID, we'd go out for lunch and I'd just ask what's on your mind, and get ideas and get thoughts and get feedback. You know, during COVID, it's been less organic. We still do it once a month and try and do it over Zoom. But we have cross-functional teams. For example, for our campaigns, our campaign meetings are cross-functional teams. And so usually they'll kick off with a brainstorming. The team actually just had one on Friday, looking ahead at the upcoming infrastructure package that we hope starting to move through the legislature later this year, and starting to think about, okay, how are ways to move this? What are some tactics? What are some ideas around this? And that's the front loading. My maximum this is, I honestly believe in Yvon Chouinard's advice in Let My People Go Surfing and when designing programs, and it's front load stakeholder engagement, because by the time that you've gone through the design phase, you've already committed 80% of your resources. And so if you have to actually make any revisions or changes and go back all the way upstream, then you've got a real problem, right? And so trying to engage stakeholders on the front end of the planning process in order to get buy-in and get any ideas and potential red flags noted before the design and implementation phase start. Then the piece that we have in place, but we're not as disciplined as we could or should be, but it's doing an AAR. At the end of every major initiative, and after action review, what went well, what worked well, what didn't work so well, what would we do the same, what would we do different? And it's honestly hard, and I think a lot of organizations go through this. It's hard because when you're really busy all the time, that's usually the piece that gets left out. So I always admire when a program leader or a project leader, or department director makes it a priority and says, "Hey, we're gonna stop and we're actually gonna do a full AAR before we move on to the next thing."
It actually sounds like you have quite a few things in place. And I love that you say this is going to be a work in progress as you grow, because there's going to be pains associated with that and changes, of course. But it sounds like you definitely have, A, importantly, trust in the organization. It sounds like your employees trust that they could come to you, but also those times set aside where you could encourage that, maybe if somebody is not feeling brave, to just proactively do it. Advocacy and being up to date on policy sounds pretty high on the list of how somebody could impress you in an application. Like, how much of a piece of their job will this be?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it depends on the position, right? Like, if you're applying for the campaigns director position, and you have no prior advocacy experience, I would say, you know, that's you may want to revise that. But if you're applying for the VP of marketing and communications, and you've done a lot of brand identity work, you've done brand narratives, you've done communications, you've done PR. You know the outdoor industry, you know how to launch a campaign, you know how to manage it, you know how to measure the metrics, et cetera, et cetera. You understand message architectures and audience segmentation and all of that good stuff, but you don't necessarily know, oh, what should be the priority in terms of legislative package and infrastructure when it comes to the grid. That's okay. Like, we'll figure that out. Like, we'll figure that out. And part of the job is to actually translate that kind of talk into something that people can understand. So certain jobs will have a higher priority on certain things, right? Like, we don't need the marketing and communications person to run political campaigns or understand deep legislative processes. That's why we have our policy and advocacy team. And we don't necessarily need our campaigns director to market segmentation. That's how these groups work together. And that's what I think makes POW so unique. It's the value add comes from literally what's the ad, because we have such a diversity of skill sets within the org.
Yeah, some people might just be scared that this is such a, you know, it's an important role, right? It's in an organization dealing with climate change, which trickles down to almost every other aspect of the outdoor industry. So it's pretty paramount in terms of its importance. And I think that a lot of folks will take your answer and feel a lot more confident about applying. So I think that's great. Within the application process, though, would you say that somebody should focus on maybe storytelling, letting you know about them, what makes them that, like, you know, maybe those soft skills and qualities? Or are you more into just hard data? You want their metrics, you want their numbers, and you want to know what they can do.
It's a balance of the two, right? So here's the thing: like, whoever we hire, we're all gonna spend a lot of time with, and so it's really important that you can have all the skills in the world. I've actually had a couple of people apply, and I'm like, you are so qualified. And I am so bored.
Yeah, you got to want to work with them, just like you said. I mean, it has to be enjoyable.
Right. And so it's like, and I don't, you know, I can't imagine having an hour check-in with you. Like, that's not, like, that wouldn't work. And then on the other hand, there's been people that I'm like, you're awesome. I would love to have you on the team. It'd be amazing to have this, like, energy and dynamism and ideas and creativity, but you don't have the experience or the skill set. And so to me, I think in an application, it's catch my attention right off the bat. Tell me a short story about yourself that catches my attention. I think, you know, there was an application that was great, and it started out with, it all started with a massive hangover the morning of March 12th, blah, 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 blah. And I was like, all right, that's ballsy. Like, how are you gonna spend this one? And they went on to tell a story about how they had spent that whole day watching environmental documentaries and learning about climate change. And that was the day that they realized, oh wow, we're in a big mess. We got to do something else. So that was a great story. And unfortunately, like, the skill set wasn't quite what we were after. So it's a matter of that. Like, I got this advice early on in my career, and I think it holds. And it's the only purpose. And I don't know if you guys would agree or not, ladies would agree or not, but the only purpose of a cover letter is to get someone to read your resume. And the only purpose of your resume is to get someone to give you an interview. And so to me, in the cover letter, it's where people are looking for your personality, for your writing style, for your approach, you know, for your overall approach. And referencing the key points in your resume is important then, because that'll say, okay, not only is this person likable, but they know what it is that we're after. So I look for that piece. I look for, what's, are they looking at this as, how would this benefit me? Or is this is what I bring to the organization? And someone that says, I'm approachable, I'm funny, I can tell a story, etc., and this is the value that I bring to the organization. You know, these are the two or three things that you should look at in my resume that will validate what I'm saying in terms of the value that I bring to the organization. To me, that cover letter gets my attention, and I'll go on to look at the resume. And then the resume, you know, does the resume substantiate what they claim in the cover letter? But also these days, like, to be honest, the first thing that I look at is somebody's LinkedIn profile.
Okay. What do you look for?
I look for, you know, how is it structured? How long have they been at previous positions? Just overall experience. It's almost like a pre-filter to the materials. I think of a resume, of a LinkedIn profile as the cliff notes to a resume, right? And so I can quickly scan. Oh yeah, that overall, this person's experience makes sense. Like, it makes sense that their journey would bring them here. I'm really interested in people's journey. Like I tell people, it's your resume. I think your resumes do a great job at telling me the what and the when. I'm really interested in also finding out the how and the why.
And that cover letter is that exact tool. You're right. It's how you show your creative acts as well, which Kevin from Snowpeak was saying is so important to him. And then a lot of people we learned don't even provide a cover letter. So it's a huge differentiator in any application anyway. But you're right, those ones that do supply it, if you can catch your attention, and it's not just this form that you're using, you know, to kind of just add the same information that is already on your resume, use your space because you don't have very much in an application. So almost every word needs to be targeted. And it's great to know that you go to LinkedIn first. I'm curious too, if you look at the activity of the candidate.
It depends. If there's some, I don't look for them to have posted or commented on something, but if they have, I'll check out what it is, or if they've published anything, I'll check out what they've published.
Basically, you're looking to see if it's a good professional profile, up to date, crisp, things of that nature, and almost like a pre-resume screen.
These days, your LinkedIn profile is your professional presence online, right? And so, if you're applying for at least at certain level roles, if you're applying for a VP role, particularly in a field like marketing and communications, I would expect that polishing your online presence. And if you're not polishing your online presence, it makes me question, are you aware that we're living in a digital age, like that, that is public information? Or because if you're not, then that's a flag. And it doesn't mean that it has to be, I don't think it's competing against other profiles. It's just like a check the box. Yes, this person is aware that they have a public presence, that they are on a public presence online, and they care about how that public presence is perceived, and they're making sure that the basics are in there.
I think that it's savvy to expect that your LinkedIn profile will be looked at if you are applying for positions. I do want to just make sure we ask you about diversity, specifically in leadership positions and within the industry, and what PAO is doing in that capacity.
Yeah, that's a really important question. Completely honest, right off the bat, we have struggled with diversity in the past. So if you look at our website, if you look at our board of directors, we have solid representation in gender diversity. I myself, I'm Hispanic, I'm Latino. So in terms of leadership positions, I think that, you know, that was a consideration for the board in the process of hiring me. I don't think that was a determining factor. But we have realized that we need to be far more intentional. So what we're doing is we're very proactively posting in different forums than would traditionally be seen by outdoor industry professionals or climate, or people in the climate industry, to try and diversify the audience that those postings reach. For the VP of development position, we were actually looking, we have added the diversity as a criteria for the search firm. We will be working with a search firm. So
okay.
we're asking that any proposal that comes in is actually considering equal opportunity and equal access in the posting. And then we've started a couple of conversations, and we're actually having a conversation on March 18th with Teresa Baker.
Within Solidarity.
So we signed on to the CEO pledge last week. I actually, we hosted an Instagram live conversation with her and myself a couple of weeks ago. And then she and I have, and this is, I mean, it's not private, it's not public, but she and I agreed that a good next step would be for us to actually have a conversation where she brings people that she knows in this space, and I bring people that I know in the environment and outdoor space into a Zoom call and start with a relatively small group. Because I think that a big part of the challenge is that the groups that represent BIPOC communities are not necessarily well known to the outdoor industry as a whole, or even in the environmental space as a whole. But then the work that the environmental organizations are doing is not really well known within the BIPOC groups, like within BIPOC groups that are doing advocacy. And so, why do we focus on tariffs? Why do we focus on fossil fuel extraction from public lands as to mitigate climate? I think there's a lot of cross-pollination of knowledge that needs to happen. And it, as that starts happening, I think it's far more likely that people start realizing, oh, that would actually be an opportunity for me, or that would actually be an area of interest, or it could be, or the reverse. It's like, this is, you know, there's a talent pool that I was not aware existed in this organization or that organization. And so while that doesn't necessarily resolve your question in terms of what's POW specifically doing in our hiring and leadership process, what we're doing is trying to have these conversations and trying to establish these platforms for there to be more cross-pollination so that we can all benefit from it.
Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of different paths that should be intersecting and they maybe aren't right now. And how can you fully and holistically solve these very large challenges without...
Something that's really important for me at POW is that we underpromise and overdeliver versus the opposite. In anything that we do, we need to be really genuine and show with what we do and the conversations that we have, rather than make big aspirational promises that we then don't know how to fulfill or can't fulfill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's very fair. Mario, before we go, is there anything else that you'd like to add that we didn't get a chance to cover?
I like to end with encouraging people to do 4% better at anything they're doing. That's kind of my spiel. You enter flow at about 4% above your current level of ability and comfort. So it's that zone somewhere between chaos and disaster where you're pushing above your current limit, but that's where you grow and where you learn. And I think that applies in so many different areas of life, like push to be 4% better at your job, or if you're applying or looking for jobs, just aim 4% higher than you think you should. And, you know, it's just be uncomfortable, step into the space where you're a little bit uncomfortable, but you're still sure you can still be pretty certain that you're not going to crash.
It's doable. That's a very approachable amount, but that's going to add up over time. And you're going to get comfortable with being uncomfortable, I think, which is kind of part of life.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for that advice. I am going to try that myself, actually, today. We're building a new website, so I'm going to try to make it 4% better today. So, Mario, thank you so much. I know that Ali thanks you as well. We completely appreciated all of your time and tips. We will get this out to our audience. I know that we have a ton of folks that are really excited to apply, you know, to be part of the team.
Thank you so much.